transportation, health, and education. And I'm delighted to introduce our speaker for this week, Wendy Goldberg. Wendy is a professor of psychology and social behavior in the School of Social Ecology. I love that name. And also in the School of Education at the University of California, Irvine. She's also the equity advisor for the School of Ecology, so actively engaged in trying to make equity work within our university, not just studying it. Wendy comes to this conversation, so she has decades of research looking at the implications of maternal employment for child development and for father's involvement. She's got a fascinating research stream, including on co-sleeping, which as a mother of small children, I was quizzing her on this morning. But also she's got this wonderful research that we're going to hear about, multiple meta-analyses looking at the implications of maternal employment for various types of child and kind of family outcomes. But also she's got this book forthcoming. She's increasingly gotten involved in looking at the fatherhood and what are sort of the factors that predict father involvement and then the implications of fatherhood for men. She's got this wonderful book coming out looking at the fatherhood and the social clock. What are the implications for men? Women have this biological clock, but what are the implications of men for whether or not they become a father at the sort of socially expected time or not, and the sort of costs and benefits of kind of going with the stream, being an early father, being a sort of father in the expected time frame, or a later father. But we're going to get to hear today about her research on do college women miss the mark when estimating the impact of maternal employment on children's development? So this is this particular look, looking at young people and how they're looking forward. I just want to highlight something, putting your work, and I mentioned this to you when we spoke, is that, you know, we've had a number of speakers this year looking at issues of maternal employment and everything from, you know, kind of country level in trying to increase fertility and the implications of maternal employment for household bargaining. And then a couple weeks ago, we were looking at maternal employment and stereotyping the workplace and pay. And I'm just very particularly excited for you to kind of bring us to get us outside, well, to bring this kind of broader familial perspective to that conversation, because we don't have as much of that, and it's obviously extremely important in the lived experience of work life and family life. So welcome, please, Wendy. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm excited to be here. And thank you for the introduction, Anna. As Hannah said, I'm going to be speaking about work and family on a more micro level. I've also been particularly interested of late in looking at the next generations, like what's our future going to look like? And one way of thinking about, you know, is our future going to be one where we're closing gender gaps, in occupations as part of the mission of your program here? And one way of getting a sense of where the future is to look at the generation coming to adulthood right now. And so that's been some of my interest in studying the college population. The talk today, I'm going to start off talking about what the public believes about maternal employment and its impact on children, then move to the meta-analysis that were just alluded to, and I'm looking ahead with looking at the college students, but I've also in my career been looking back, where have we been? What have we learned from doing 50 years of research in a particular area? So I'm going to use the research that has been done in the past, our meta-analyses of that research, to provide the standard of what the research tells us, what does the science tell us about the impact of maternal employment on children, and then move to talking about the accuracy of college women stereotypes. That's really the heart of my talk today. And then the implications for policy at the end. You're welcome to interrupt with questions if you want. If it's something I'll be getting to, I'll let you know that. Okay, so first what the public believes about maternal employment. Before we get to a public beliefs, though, and I imagine you all are familiar with the information on this slide, but this is showing you the employment status of women and how it varies by the age of the child. So the first column here is women with their own children under 18, women with own children 6 to 17 years of age, women with own children under 6, women with own children under 3, under 2, 1, and under a year. And so you can see the blue bar is employed full time, and as the child's, you know, we have a drop off when we start getting into women being employed with young children. Now, in terms of what the public believes, I'm just showcasing some magazine covers here, and they vacillate between focusing on moms' economic contributions to the labor force. So, you know, we did it. What happens when women are over half the workforce? To the costs, you know, applied costs for children, the case for staying home, or Anne Marie Slaughter's article, Why Women Still Can't Have It All. So you can see there's ambivalence in the mass media, just as, you know, represented by the selection of covers. There's also ambivalence in public opinion. So a new Pew Research Center survey finds that the public remains of two minds about the gains that mothers have made in the workplace. Okay, most people recognize the clear economic benefits to families, so the families earn enough to live comfortably. 67% say, you know, that that is true. But they've voiced concerns about the costs, the toll that having a working mother may take on children or even on marriage. So about three-quarters of adults say that the increasing number of women working for pay has made it harder for parents to raise children, and half said that it's made marriages harder to succeed. So while they're saying it's helped families live more comfortably, they're also saying, you know, there's a cost. While the vast majority of Americans, you know, 79%, reject the idea that women should return to their traditional roles, this new Pew Research survey finds that the public still holds different views of the best situation for children, depending upon whether mothers or fathers are the focus. So we're seeing, you know, differences by gender of parent here. About 51% of the survey respondents said that children are better off if a mother is home and doesn't hold a job, while just 8% would say the same of fathers, that children would be better off with a father home and not employed. So in research, too, we see that scholars who have studied work and family, they find that concerns still persist about the potential for maternal employment to lessen the quality and quantity of mothers' time with children. One study saying maternal employment, even if the norm, and it's been normative now for, you know, for decades, is still not optimal. And it's beliefs about full-time employment that are particularly negative, and that's going to be the focus of my talk today. Okay, so what do 50 years of research tell us? What I have up here are the two meta-analyses that we've published, and it's going to be the results of these meta-analyses that are going to provide, you know, the standard then for assessing what science has told us. The reason why we ended up doing the meta-analysis is because the results from individual studies that have been conducted over the last 50 years have been contradictory. The research has spanned disciplines. You know, the research comes out of economics, comes out of sociology, comes out of psychology, and it goes from studies that find no association between maternal employment and child outcomes to studies that find, for example, that achievement scores are higher among children of non-employed mothers. Also, studies found achievement scores are higher among children of employed mothers. And then studies, you know, find that a recent British study found that fewer behavior problems for girls in dual earner families. So the research is all over the map, and the variation is due to things like the child age, child gender, family structure, is it a one or two parent family, the socioeconomic status of the families in the studies, the characteristics of the mother's work. But the statement from 1999 is still true today, that the state of the science is inconclusive. The literature on maternal labor force participation and academic achievement extends back over the past three decades now. We can make that another four and a half. But the evidence from this literature has not led to any clear assessment of the extent to which maternal labor force participation has a detrimental or beneficial effect on child outcomes. So the situation was ripe for meta-analysis. This is the perfect time to do a meta-analysis as a way of summarizing a vast body of research, especially one where there's been inconclusive data. So a meta-analysis, for those of you who may not be as familiar with it, protects against over-interpreting results of a few studies by aggregating data from many empirical studies and across multiple operationalizations of a construct. It moves beyond tests of significance to a focus on effect sizes, you know, the magnitude of the difference, and it allows for tests of moderating factors that might influence the nature or the extent of the association. So we conducted the two meta-analyses that I had on that title slide. The first one, we reviewed 68 studies of concurrent maternal employment. So that concurrent meaning that if the mother's employment was assessed at the same time point as the child outcome. So if they were looking at, if the study was looking at mothers of preschoolers and their employment, the outcomes were of preschoolers, not of those children when they become adolescents. The second meta-analysis, we looked at 69 studies that were done of early maternal employment. Those were studies focused on maternal employment during the first 3 years of the child's life, and the outcomes there were children's achievement and problem behaviors. As you can see, the studies spanned decades, going from 1961 to 2005 in one hand and 2010 in the other. The outcomes of interest in our meta-analyses were children's achievement and behavior. Although a wide range of child outcomes has been studied in relation to parental employment, and they include things like childhood obesity, the quality of the attachment relationship with the parent, but much of the research on the consequences of maternal employment for children has concentrated either on the domains of cognition achievement or on socio-emotional development. And those are the domains that we chose to focus on in the meta-analysis. So we focused on achievement, and we operationalized that as meaning scores on IQ tests, scores on formal tests of reading, language, or math achievement, school grades, or your GPA, and teacher-reported cognitive abilities. We also, in our second meta-analysis, the one on early maternal employment, looked at children's behavior problems, which were children's internalizing behaviors, such as depression and low self-esteem, or children's externalizing behavior problems, such as aggression and defiance. Without taking you through the details of the meta-analyses, what we found was that the associations between concurrent maternal employment and achievement produced either non-significant or marginally very small positive effects on achievement. Okay, so we found, you know, basically there was no cause for alarm in looking at concurrent maternal employment and children's achievement. So either summarizing across all those studies, it was a non-significant null effect or overall a small positive effect. And in that meta-analysis and in the next one, moderators were very important, like family structure, the gender of the child, the age of the child, those kinds of characteristics. Yes?
So to what extent in evaluating this vast body of research do you try and account for the extent to which the study deals with correlation versus causation?
Oh, good point. And nearly all the studies are correlations. So you're going to hear me use the term effects, and that's the language of meta-analysis. Okay, so when I speak about a small effect, that's kind of like statistical jargonese for the effect size. And what we have here really are correlations, because we can't experimentally assign, like, okay, you're going to have an employed mom full-time and you're going to have a non-employed mom, so we can't assign children, you know, to different employment situations. What, there are selection biases and other factors that go on. So,
but you could think of experimental designs that get closer to causation and further away from correlation. For example, if the economy is that a mother who's just had a baby might be less likely to do it than if the economy is booming. So you could look at kids of the same mother, when the mother was working with one child and not the other child.
Right.
I think
right.
the experimental design is right. closer to causation than
right.
the correlation.
No,
you put differential weight on those.
We did not necessarily with the very good example that you gave, like the economic context, because that does pull sometimes it pulls women into the labor force, sometimes it pushes them out. But we did weight the quality of the studies, and so some had random samples, some had stronger research designs than others, and that is in the meta-analysis we took into account the quality of the nature of the research design. The quality of the journal in which it was published. So we took into account, the better studies got a higher rating in terms of having random samples or then community samples rather than, small selected samples and that kind of thing. Oh, so we go back, oops, went back too far. Okay. Second study, the bottom line there was that the associations between maternal employment and child outcomes revealed a marginally very small effect, a negative effect for formal achievement tests, a small positive effect for teacher ratings, and a small negative effect for internalizing behavior. So we ended up with not a clear statement here in terms of we still had a mixed bag even with the meta-analysis, but we found that the negative associations were coming through from full-time intensive work in the first year of life. And that this study wasn't, the outcomes were not measured concurrently, so it wasn't about maternal employment in the first year and its impact on infant scores on, a Bayley test in the first year, but rather it was maternal employment early in the child's life for development later. Okay, so now the meta-analysis, yes?
I just have one question
sure.
about the findings. Was there any attempt to isolate between single-parent homes and two-parent homes in that?
Yes, in both studies we did. That was one of the most important moderators in both studies. So we found you get, so whether or not you're going to get positive effects, what I gave you were the bottom lines, but you'll see we have a host of moderators, including family structure. And in single-parent families, there was often a positive effect of maternal employment on child outcomes. And there is probably the economic resources that are brought in by the moms working were goods that the children could have had, more exposure to books in the home and things like that, that we got a boost on achievement. Okay, perhaps also as well as the role modeling. It seemed more disadvantaged for middle-class kids within a two-parent home than for single moms. Mm-hmm.
Is there anything about extended family caretaking in the early years? Or?
Not in the meta-analysis per se, but some work from some other work, like say from the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, has had a multi-year study of the importance of alternative care and its impact on child development, alternative to mom care. And they've had grandparent care, in that study. Certainly, that's one place where you could get a grandparent effect. We looked at whether child care was controlled for in our meta-analyses, but didn't go to looking at the nature of that alternative care, which can include another parent, include grandparents. It's an important area because there are more grandparents now who are assuming active care of the grandchildren. They are primary caregivers, and that number has been going up.
Yes. Can you also briefly clarify how you define intensive labor and also if there were any regional differences in how people experience or how to participate in their workplace, how that might impact their household? Sort of thinking about the north versus the south and this sort of idea that it's slower pace in the south and that it might be less intense labor and a little bit more efficient.
That's a really good question. We didn't stratify in the meta-analysis by region of the U.S. We did look at non-U.S. samples. So we had international samples and we found more positive effects there. So the studies that were not done in the U.S. And it could be because there are better supports for families and in other countries, as you all are aware of, in terms of leave policies or subsidized daycare. That's your second question, but what's the first part of your question?
Just how to define, how you define.
Oh, intensive, yes. Labor. So intensive labor would be defined in our study by hours, and so it would have been full-time or more, which would have been by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, kind of 35 hours a week or more. So we didn't look at the super, the 80-hour a week jobs. But those would all been those would have been collapsed in with the over. It would have been normal full-time along with intensive full-time would have been together. So our question was, are the views of college women toward maternal employment consistent with the scientific data? So we aim to understand whether the views of the educated emerging adults about their future employment and its effects are consistent with the scientific evidence, or are they more like the kind of ambivalence that we were seeing in the public. Our method was to apply a notion, a construct from social psychology, that of stereotype accuracy, to elucidate young women's thoughts about the impact of their own future employment on children. Now, this topic is important because young women's plans matter. Okay, things happen. I mean, we all have plans, and then unexpected life circumstances occur, and we can't always follow through on those. Sociologist Kathleen Gerson has talked about the unexpected obstacles that come your way or unexpected benefits that come your way. You get a promotion you didn't expect. You end up staying with a job that you thought you'd leave. There's a recession. You get laid off from your job, and you end up being more invested in home and child rearing, and you have another kid you didn't think you'd have. So, things change. But still, what we know from research is that plans do make a difference, and they are good, not perfect, but they're good predictors of future educational achievement and occupational status. And our concern was that if young women are overestimating the negative and underestimating the positive effects of full-time employment for children, that they may make educational and occupational decisions that avoid careers that usually demand a full-time commitment. So if they're in medical school, and we know that women are well represented in medical school these days, but if they end up choosing a specialty that's, say, a non-surgical specialty, that will be carry less prestige and less pay than surgical specialties, but it also may buy them more flexibility, and that may be in their mind, even if they loved surgery and were really good at it, as residents. And those these kind of views, if they're acted upon, will pose an obstacle to reducing the gender gap in occupational segregation and have consequences for the women themselves. And even if their views are accurate or overly positive about the effects of maternal employment on children, then the women may be more likely to return to work soon after having a child and have few interruptions in their work life, yet doing it all might leave them vulnerable to stress from insufficient support from, their partners or the workplace, the inadequate parental leave policies that we have, and the lack of affordable daycare. Okay, so that's kind of the policy implications that will be in our mind, too, in doing this research. But let me move now to talking specifically about stereotype accuracy. Okay, so stereotypes are beliefs about groups of people, objects, or ways of doing things that may or may not reflect reality. A stereotype accuracy is the extent to which beliefs are supported by research. So essentially, stereotype accuracy is saying, how much truth is there in a given stereotype? The early views of stereotypes, I mean, the word stereotype carries a negative connotation. And historically, they were seen as exaggerations of group differences. They were seen as stereotypes were seen as things that fueled prejudice, discrimination. And some contemporary researchers still see stereotypes as inaccurate, unfair overgeneralizations. Since about 1995, the thinking has been to advocate a neutral stance that stereotypes are neither inherently accurate or inaccurate, and the recommendation was that stereotypes, the accuracy of stereotypes, be tested empirically. For example, stereotypes have been looked at in the area of gender, like gender differences in men and women's cognitive abilities. Is that accurate? Inaccurate. And stereotypes can impinge upon young women's thoughts and attitudes as they make educational and occupational decisions that can have long-term consequences. So our study provides the first empirical demonstration of stereotype accuracy about the effects of maternal employment on children. Calculating stereotype accuracy by comparing participants' estimates to actual meta-analytic effect sizes has come to constitute a gold standard for the scoring of accuracy. And you'll see if you look at stereotype accuracy in the area of gender differences, you'll see the application of meta-analytic effect sizes in those studies. The objective of our research was to investigate the accuracy of college women's beliefs about the impact of their future employment on children. Our hypothesis, based upon our own research and the Pew research studies, were that college women, the Pew studies were of the public in general, that college women will overestimate the negative effects and underestimate the positive effects of their full-time employment on children's development. Our sample were 1,259 women from the UC Irvine campus. They were students who volunteered to participate in the study for extra credit. The mean age was about 20 years. 82% of the students were born in the U.S. 60% had mothers who were employed either part or full time when they were infants. And the sample's ethnic and racial diversity reflects our campus, which is majority Asian. So a sample was 55% Asian American, 21% European American, 13% Hispanic American, 5% Middle Eastern, 1% African American, 0.5% American Indian, and 2% two or more ethnicities. Obviously, this is not representative of the racial ethnic distribution of our country at large, but it was of our campus, although our sample had more psychology, social science, anthropology, political science types of majors than the campus as a whole. Good question. The convenience factor wasn't what drove this. Most of my life has been spent doing research where I'm collecting observational data, and I spend hundreds of hours coding videotapes. So for me, this was a treat, I have to say, to do a college student study, but it's been by no means my history. So that doesn't drive it. I'm really interested in the generation coming to adulthood, particularly young women who are positioned to take on demanding, competitive jobs, and seeing what is going to hold, what is it that is holding them back from reaching their, fulfilling their dreams, if it will be. And you'll see at the very end here when I talk about future research, we do want to extend it, number one, to other college campuses, but also to to women who are not college-bound as well. So, but we started here with the interest of seeing, can we see change? And part of also what drove the focus on college women is the concern that I'm sure you've all heard about, of opting out, right, of whether you get young women opting out of the labor force, opting out of high-pressure jobs. And so we're trying to get at understanding that phenomenon too. Are we going to see, do we see a difference here, or are we going to have another generation? We've had a plateau in women's labor force participation. It hasn't gone up in recent years. So it's, again, it's those, that's those kinds of trends and interest in addressing those. So our procedures were to do an online survey via SurveyMonkey. The measures in the survey were in this listed here in this order: demographic information about their own parents' employment and division of labor, their gender ideology, their estimates of future employment on child outcomes, which is the heart of the study, beliefs about the costs and benefits of maternal employment for children, and their intrinsic and extrinsic work values.
It seems like from what you're talking about, and I'll share the thinking of why I asked,
that all of this presumes marriage is the path. And mm-hmm. I'm Victoria Butson, I'm the executive director mm-hmm. here, and I've been teaching students on the Harvard campus how to run for public office for about 10 years. I have never experienced a greater intensity around concern about the marriage market than I have in the last 12 months. I'm not, I really haven't, and it's consistent that there's this real focus on how their choices will make them marriageable or non-marriageable, and how marriage will or won't impact, in essence, their ability to run for office. I don't see that when I'm teaching women, and it's predominantly U.S., but not mm-hmm. wholly U.S. It's not so different from the Irvine data that you just mm-hmm. showed. But it's not something that I hear when I train in other areas or regions predominantly. But I'm interested, just the way you're talking about this generation that's
yeah,
coming.
Right.
The focus is if that were so pivotal, it seems unlikely to me that it could be as pivotal as they would, they imagine it.
Mm.
Or that they have as much control as they imagine.
Yes, that you're certainly right. That's also your information for the last 12 months. I mean, that's really quite something to hear. That's,
and I don't know if it's the can you have it all,
right?
Which is sort of really
right.
catalyzed constant
yeah.
thinking and made that a question kind
mm-hmm.
of yet again.
Right.
You know. So.
Yeah. But I don't think, you know, for us, marriage is what we didn't ask them per se, do you plan to get married? So it's really about children, and there has been an increase in living, cohabiting without marriage. So
mm-hmm.
it, you know, and also in same sex relationships. So I don't think we're assuming,
okay.
We're assuming what we did assume is having children, although we in the future want to sort out women who don't plan to have children, because it could be that one of the reasons why women don't plan to have children is that they think it's not going to be compatible with a
right.
high-pressure career. And so I think that's important to get at, but we weren't able to sort that out in the study.
Question, was it just about the health and welfare of the child as opposed to their own health and welfare?
In our study, yes. So other research has been you know, about women's work and well-being.
Right.
But this was really about the impact on kids and how much that may be a factor in career decision making. Participants were asked to envision, and if you look at the handout on your table, I for the podcast, oh, I'm good. I have, and there's some extra copies here. I have a slide that's going to show this too, but you won't be able to see it too well. So I thought I would give you a handout. This is what this particular one page of this. Part of the survey asks, okay? So they were asked to envision the effect that their full-time, over 35 hours a week employment would have on their children's development. And the line was, thinking ahead, if you were employed full-time, how much effect do you think it would have on your child or children in each area listed below? And on that handout, you'll see that we list the outcome areas, and those outcome areas were deliberately selected to correspond to the meta-analysis focus on achievement and problem behaviors. So we set up, we anticipate in designing the survey, we intended to look at their responses in relation to the meta-analytic effect sizes and to really apply this notion of stereotype accuracy. The response choices were 8 evenly spaced categories ranging from no effect to very strong effect, and those corresponded to the meta-analytic terminology. The estimated effects of the employment on children were converted to numerical ratings using Cohen's effect size guidelines, which range from 0.00 to 0.60. So a small effect is about 0.10, a medium effect about 0.30, and over 0.50, a large effect. Participants were also asked to choose from 3 answer options to indicate whether they believe their employment would benefit, harm, or have no effect on each of the child outcomes. And we then applied positive or negative signs to the effect raising, to the effect ratings based upon the direction of the stereotypes. So this is what you have in a handout here, and you can see that the upper section shows you the evenly spaced 8 squares, and the bottom section shows you the, you know, ask them about whether it's going to benefit or harm or have no effect on the children. Following the lead of studies of stereotype accuracy in regard to race and gender, the participants' estimates about the magnitude and direction of effects of maternal employment on children were compared to actual meta-analytic effects. We also followed the lead of studies of stereotype accuracy in examining predictors of individual differences in stereotype accuracy. So effect sizes, again, refer to the magnitude of the association between the independent and dependent variables without implying causal relationships. And it's really, it's the strength of the relationship between maternal employment on the one hand and these child outcomes on the other. Okay, so the big question, are college women accurate? Meta-analytic effect sizes in this column were averaged on achievement. They were averaged from the two meta-analyses, the one, the concurrent and the early one. The internalizing and externalizing behaviors effect sizes were only drawn from the early meta-analysis because we didn't have those outcomes in the other ones. The middle column in blue shows you the effect sizes of the college women's estimates. And the accuracy is the last column there. So what we found is that the sample as a whole, and then we did, we took the absolute value of the differences, did t-tests on those differences. They were all significant. And then this is showing you small, small, medium, medium, large, the size of the inaccuracy. So as a whole, the sample overestimated the negative impact of full-time employment on children. So all differences between the meta-analytic and average estimated effect sizes were in the direction of the young women being more negative than the meta-analytic standard. The behavior had a larger discrepancy than achievement. The largest discrepancy was between full-time employment and external behavior, and within achievement, the largest discrepancy was for GPA. Now, I'm going to give you other data, but I thought before I'm going to talk to you about the predictors. Yeah,
can you go back one?
Sure.
This looks like the largest discrepancy is for externalizing behavior.
But this is a positive number, and that's negative, so it's actually, yes, externalizing behaviors has the largest.
Okay.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, because this is positive.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So before I'm going to talk to you about predictors of their inaccuracy in a moment, but I want to think for a moment about why they're missing the mark.
Can I interrupt?
Sure. Yeah.
Can you also just define, I think externalizing behaviors is like misbehavior of your child. Is that,
it's aggression, defiance, that kind of thing. These often come, when you're doing the meta-analysis, you're aggregating across all kinds of outcomes that we code as, define as external behaviors. Many of them came from the Achenbach child behavior checklist, which has internalizing like things like depression and self-esteem and externalizing behaviors, which would be acting out.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's helpful.
Uncooperative kinds of behaviors. So since that, and also that had the biggest gap, and perhaps women are believing that mothers need to be there to supervise the kids to have them develop the kind of self-regulatory behaviors and work habits that could lead to higher grades and better behaviors. So we'll have time at the end to talk more about implications, but I just wanted to kind of put that out there as a possibility of what might be going on in their mind. So we then wanted to understand what predicts from our data that of the variables we had in our data set, what predicts individual differences in stereotype accuracy. And we looked at demographic variables such as race, ethnicity, whether they were U.S. born or not, whether their own mothers were employed during their infancy or not, and their year in college. We looked at attitudinal variables, which are traditional gender ideology, which is like whether they support more separate spheres or gender equity. We looked at gender ideology in the areas of work and on the domestic front. We looked at the beliefs about costs and benefits of maternal employment using a scale that my colleagues and I developed back in 1988. And then also we looked at intrinsic and extrinsic work values, their reasons for wanting to work. Do they want to work because they want the money and the external rewards of work, or do they want to work for fulfillment, creativity, those kinds of reasons? What we found was that the predictors of full-time employment and achievement. These factors are the ones that came out to be significant predictors. And Caucasian European American women were more negative than women who identified as being from multiracial or ethnic, multi-ethnic backgrounds. In our sample, the most common multiracial or multi-ethnic background was having parents who were Hispanic and Asian, and or people who identified as other. Having traditional gendered work attitudes predicted being more negative than people who had non-traditional attitudes about gender in work, like whether women should be supervisors and leaders. Beliefs in fewer costs to maternal employment predicted more positive stereotypes, and higher extrinsic work values predicted more positive work, more positive attitudes about the impact of their own future employment on children. When it came to behavior problems, a lot, even more variables came up as significant. The most consistent predictors of individual differences were attitudes, particularly traditional gendered attitudes around work, and beliefs about the costs of maternal employment and extrinsic work values. The potency of gender role attitudes and the beliefs about costs of maternal employment for children suggests that the concerns about maternal employment underlie young women's stereotypes and may drive future decisions about the extent of employment when rearing children. So that's how these predictors may help us see what it is that is, you know, behind their thoughts.
Could you talk a little about your measure of the costs?
Yes, the measure of cost. This was a scale that my colleagues and I developed back in the 80s, kind of following the big surge in the employment of women in the big surge in middle class women's employment that occurred during the 1980s. And our measure there looks at whether people believe that, let's say, with a mother that stay having an employed mother, children are just as secure when their mothers are employed, or children of employed mothers are more likely to get into trouble, or children of employed mothers are more likely to be juvenile delinquents, or children of employed mothers are less likely to do well in school, or children learn how to be more independent when they have an employed mother. Children have more equal ideas about gender when they have an employed mother. And we had two subscales in that measure. One was the cost subscale, and one was the benefits. The stronger predictor is the cost subscale. So it's really the concerns that are driving. It's not the thinking of the good things that can come from maternal employment. It's these concerns about the cost for children that seem to be behind the stereotype inaccuracy. And it's asking, the inaccuracy is about a related topic. It's about the impact, right, the impact of employment on children. So it's not surprising that it comes out to be, you know, close, but there are different constructs because actually they relate differently to other variables in the study, so they're not all tapping the same thing. To summarize then, we examined the extent to which young women's thoughts about the effects of their future employment on children were similar to meta-analytic data. The college women tended to miss the mark by overestimating the negative effects of full-time employment on children. The extent of their inaccuracy varied by several demographic and attitudinal variables, as well as by the type of child outcome. And the conundrum seems to be that college women, and if we can assume that they are, by the fact of being in a four-year university, high-achieving and have career aspirations, and I realize that's an assumption, that they hold view, that the conundrum is that these women who are, by their status, high-achieving, hold views that their own full-time employment will be negative for children. So now I'd like to talk about the implications for the women and for work-family policies. Women with neutral or positive stereotypes may be more likely to see full-time employment as a personal choice with few adverse consequences for children, and thus may have a career trajectory with few interruptions for child-rearing. Women with negative stereotypes may view maternal employment as conflicting with a high value on intensive mothering. If they can choose the extent of their employment, they may opt for part-time employment or a mommy track. So despite maternal employment being normative for decades and the years of research showing that it's not harmful, college women, at least in our sample, are harboring concerns about working full-time. And yet there are costs for part-time work, for women's careers and for their well-being. Working part-time may ease combining work and care of children, but it could lessen the satisfaction that they derive from their jobs. It could cause more fatigue. Very often women who work part-time are trying to do it all on the home front as well as work. It could get more mothers into the labor force. If, let's say, you had more part-time work with benefits, it might be attractive for something that would pull more women into the labor force. But it could increase the gender segregation in jobs and your work against pay equity. It may be good for retention after childbirth, for women going back to work after childbirth, but it could have adverse impact on their career, on their income, and on benefits. A study that was done with a meta-analysis of 38 studies found little differences between part and full-time work on job satisfaction, but yet another study found that women were more satisfied with part-time work if they were older, if they were married, and if it was supplemental income. So this is a complex topic that I'm just want to say that the young women may not be thinking about the cost to part-time work. They may see it as an ideal solution. And in fact, in data that I'm not showing here because it's not part of the article that we just published on this study, but we do look at the same questions that you see there for full-time work. We also ask for part-time work. We also ask for no employment. And we do find that this sample tends to idealize part-time work. So they tend to see more positive benefits of part-time work on children than we saw with the full-time work. So there is some concern that we have. Mm-hmm.
Did you look at the how the women responded based on the age of the children or the projected age, that there were younger children versus high schoolers?
We would like to do that. We're sorry that we hadn't done that, okay, because it's implied by those questions that the kids are school-age when you talk about things like school grades, but we didn't specify infants, school-age, older children, and we would do that in a subsequent study. And we'd also, in a subsequent study, would specify maternal employment. For women, we say your own employment. We had some men filled out the survey, too, but because we didn't say maternal employment, we were getting men's views of their employment, which we will look at, but we also want to get men's thoughts about women's employment and those, things that we have in our plans to do. This is, we talked a little bit with one of the questions before about impacts on women's well-being, and there is other research on this. There are costs of staying home for women's well-being. Stay-at-home moms report more negative emotions and fewer positive emotions. You can see there, you may not be able to see, but here we've got worry, sadness, stress, anger, depression, and stay-at-home moms, employed moms, and employed women with no child at home. It's in the area, the stay-at-home moms worry more, just looking at percentages here, they report being more sad, and they report being more depressed. And it's interesting, the stress level is fairly comparable, 50%, 48%, anger, 19%, 14%. But just to say, the association with women's well-being is it's been a very lively area of research, and it's,
I'm just wondering, home moms with their children, I assume they are more happier than the birth from their children. But naturally speaking, when women have a child, the whole, even if in workplace, she's always thinking about her child. Mm-hmm. I'm a mother, but mm-hmm. I'm experiencing it. So at least if there is no pressure of financial problems or any social problem, whatever it is, very, very important for a mother, once she has a child, to stick with the child and take care of everything, and mm-hmm. even if she has a maid or whatever assistance she has, if she's around the child psychologically, it's good for the children, it's good for the mother, it's good for the whole family.
Well, I think the research, you've brought up some of the things that make a difference about, let's say, the income, right, the financial situation. Are they home by choice? Are they not home by choice? There's research showing that if there's a mismatch between what women prefer and what they're actually doing, they're a higher risk for depression. So it's complicated. But the backstory is not captured just by the summary percentages there. Benefits of full-time work for women's well-being. Research shows that steady work offers the greatest mental and physical health benefits at middle age. Women who worked full-time following the birth of their first child had better physical and mental health at age 40 than women who had not worked for pay. Obviously, low pay, low flexibility jobs exert a cost on mental health. So we're not talking, you know, all jobs are not created equal here. But that's the study here, if you're, you know, interested in that. And these benefits remained even after they controlled for selection effects. The selection effects would be that people who are feeling good, health, you know, physical health-wise, mental health-wise, are the ones who are seeking the full-time work. And so after they controlled for selection effects, they still found those associations. So based upon our research, we think that, you know, college women need good information, right? We know the public, out there in the public, there are mixed messages. We need to have better dissemination of research findings, you know, such as results of the meta-analyses to the public. College counselors and college workshops could be held to dispel myths about the effects of full-time employment on children. Gender role flexibility is needed, you know, at the family level to make sure children are well cared for and to make sure that families are provided for. Family-friendly workplace policies and climates. I know you all are interested in things like that, but we need to have not only the policies in place, but also a climate that says you can use those policies. And I were talking before about people, you know, men in corporate situations who or other, you know, law firms, whatever, are disadvantaged by taking advantage of policies that are on the books, but if they use them, it counts against them, and that also, you know, can apply to women in situations that they're seen as less committed somehow. So the workplace policy and climates, the climate that it's okay to use this and there's no penalty. And work-family policies such as paid parental leave and affordable child care. I thought I'd be remiss if I didn't say that I've been talking a lot about choice and about privileged, you know, college students, young women who are in a four-year, it's a public university, but a four-year university. This notion of choice is not relevant for many women. Not all women have equal access to long-term full-time jobs. Women from disadvantaged backgrounds are most likely to have repeated bouts of unemployment, to have a nonlinear labor force attachment. And when employed at low wages, it's hard to find and afford good quality child care, and so we have need to have good quality subsidized child care. And paid parental leaves, paid sick leave for women who are employed at the at lower end or low paying jobs. And in fact, you know, the boost in health benefits at midlife would probably lead to lower health costs in the long run. I'm not an economist, but I just, you know, put that out there, these kinds of things were in place. So our future research, as I've hinted at some of these, we would like to replicate it with other college samples and also community samples. We'd like to include maternal employment measures other than status or hours, so other characteristics of jobs, other aspects of child development like attachment, follow up to see the actual career choices and trajectories, what do they really end up doing 5 years, 10 years from now, examine within Asian and within Hispanic variation. We're very fortunate to have a sample that was diverse in terms of having a large number of Asian and Hispanic students, but these are not homogeneous categories, and so we have students from a lot of different Asian countries, a lot of different Hispanic countries, and so it would be good to look in a more nuanced way within those samples, but we didn't have the sample size to do that, and also to include young men. We do have, as I said, some data on them, but we haven't analyzed it yet.
For future research, I think it would be really interesting to include young men, not just to predict, get a sense of how they view effect of women working full-time or part-time, but also how they view their own part-time or full-time work?
Yes.
And to design the survey tool that has that could be less likely to be given prompts, because it indicates that it may be harmful, which kind of tells the user that some of them should probably list as harmful and some of them should probably list as benefit. But if it was a broader survey mechanism where these are kind of embedded.
So not so obvious.
Yeah. Because I think that particularly for the female sample, you know, women are really pickled in shoulds. You know, you should do this and you shouldn't do that. And I know what I'm supposed to believe is good. I think very few messages from society would tell women that they should feel really good about being less present for their child.
Right.
That they would be less likely to think that that was reasonable to put down on a piece of paper, even if they fought it. But to see if you might be able, you know, it might have no effect, but
I think
it might shave
it's
some
a good
of the edge off that.
It's a really good suggestion.
Be interesting
yeah.
to see.
Yeah, and we are going to make revisions, obviously. So that's
yeah.
great. Thank you for
that's
that suggestion.
Really interesting to see.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I have the same kind of feeling because in this sample, if the second question was the first, you offer them the possibility of talking about benefit. But the first question, everything is negative, only non-effect. But all the others are negative. So it looks like the researcher is looking for how much negative you think that this is. So you do not allow the person who fills the survey to think that could be really positive, extraordinary, or whatever. And in one research, in the same line than Victoria, and I think that I will suggest a qualitative technique, something like a focus group or something like that, that just with a prompt that do not show what you are looking for.
Right. You know, your point is so well taken. And in fact, you know, we that's why we had the benefits, that second part there. But you're right, you know, certainly about perhaps the way that first part was worded. When we developed our measure of the belief scale with costs and benefits, one of the things we did there deliberately was to have benefits, because almost all of the like general social surveys items were always phrased in terms of negative. It was always negative about maternal work and always positive about having a employed father. That's always good, you know. Employed mother, that can only have these potential negative outcomes and maybe more or less of them. And so that's a wrong that we tried to right. And yet you can see, like, even with that consciousness for all these years, I think, you know, your point's well taken.
I think that question is right on the mark, because when I read the question, I thought the exact same thing. It's framed in terms of harms. And then I went back and read it again. And question one says nothing about harm. It's like, how much of an effect do you think it would have? And the effect could be positive or negative.
That's how we meant it.
Positive or negative. But the fact that, you know, we're reading the question, and our implicit association we have with this question is the effect must be negative, and that's not even in the question. It's not until you designed it very well.
Well, thank you. Thank you. But I was discouraged that.
Positive or negative, but designing it well, you can't overcome it.
What we all bring to it. What we bring to it. Yeah. Well, thank you. I thought maybe there was still some wording there that made you think that it was negative. I should also say that, you know, one of the things we found in the meta-analysis was in one of them, we found that the year of publication made a difference. That the more recent studies were showing somewhat more positive outcomes than the older studies, because as maternal employment became more normative, it kind of fits, right? You'd expect that the studies done more recently. But we couldn't tease apart when we compared the young women's estimates to the meta-analytic estimates. We didn't separate it out by the recency of those studies. It wasn't something methodologically facile to do. But it could be that the women's discrepancies are even greater because those more recent studies were positive, right? So if anything, the young women are more negative than, you know, the recent studies, which is more of a concern.
I really like your idea of exposure to benefits. You know, I do think I very much share your perspective and others. You know, the conversation is so negative, very one-sided about the implications of maternal employment. And it might be interesting to experimentally try to get at you know, if you, you know, at the beginning of your survey, assign people to information about, you know, differential information about maternal employment,
mm-hmm.
just to see whether or not that affected their ratings, you know, to see whether some of that would, I mean, even, I don't know, long term, but to see whether or not you can at least get a shift in an openness of perspective, because that might be.
That'd be great, and that's easy to do with a college population, too. That's the kind of thing
that's
easy.
You could do it, right, well, but it also would make sense with the college population, because that is an opportunity for intervention. I mean, that's an institutional context in which you could have interventions, you could have more. Could I just follow up on two things on this? We did this one study with a graduate student, it was a small sample, looking at professional students like graduating from MBA programs and looking forward about, you know, family and career planning. And what was interesting and just in the qualitative data was, you know, the guys seemed like they were able to have more of these conversations actually about their thoughts about family planning
mm-hmm.
and career planning than were the women. And in some ways,
mm-hmm.
it was probably more likely the women who are going to experience that pinch than the men. It's not exclusively. I think that's shifting,
mm-hmm.
as we've discussed. But I think that there are more, I wonder whether there is more inhibition for women to talk about those things. I mean, as a very young woman, I remember I loved children, but when I was a young professional woman, I avoided them if they were at a party. I would never signal. I would never look away. You know, I'd never want to signal that I was one of those who like children, you know, because that would signal negatively. And I think similarly, like when you're coming out of an MBA program, you know, women might feel more inhibited than men
mm-hmm.
to mention, oh, well, what about children and stuff with all this discussion about women opting out and all that. And so actually, you know, it could actually be kind of profound in these, you know, professional training contexts and college and stuff to actually provide space for, you know, conversation, open conversation and planning about how would I manage this, what, you know, how could I do this, what are, you know, what expectations do I need kind of reality tested and stuff like that. I think it would be very, very healthy.
That's great ideas, and I think you're right about women feeling inhibited about talking about children, whereas men don't, because it's actually very welcome when men do.
Right.
It's seen as like, oh, you know, they're being.
They likely get a relational bonus.
They get props.
higher achieving men to have more children. You know,
yeah.
Whereas it's not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
It's a very, very interesting for me, especially because I really used to do the research for Radcliffe College a long time ago. You know what? This time is a real new day for women. I'm
mm-hmm.
so alive, but just this change, you know. And what I'm thinking now is men are trying to involve themselves to take care of the children,
mm-hmm.
but they really don't know how to do it. Sometimes when I go to the shopping or on the way, you know, they just carry like they are carrying like object, or they don't know how to handle it. They are trying to obey now.
Well, I think we're seeing differences. I think what the research shows is that
we need to train them from little kids.
They need that socialization. But also, we're seeing evidence that men can be as nurturing as women, and certainly in a same-sex male couples, we're seeing men being nurturing, and even in heterosexual couples, right around after childbirth, men have lower testosterone levels. They're going down. Their prolactin levels are higher. So there's more, there's even a physiological response for men. But I saw more hands. Thank you though, for your comment.
Yes,
that was a perplexing finding for us. It's not one that we expected to see, nor wanted to see, to be quite frank. And so we don't know what's going on with that. But college women whose own mothers were working during their infancy. So we wanted to not just get at work, right? Because 60% of our sample had mothers who were employed either part or full time, but mothers who were employed during their infancy, saw negative impacts of maternal employment. So,
infancy described as 0 to 12 months, or
just infancy. So whatever they brought to the table on that one.
Fascinating. And fascinating too, because I would imagine that one can't actually accurately self-report on it.
That's
so
right.
It's mythic, right?
Right.
It's
not their memory.
Really interesting thing to test.
Yeah, that would be nice for in a focus group, you know, to really get that, because that's not something that you can really.
It's a familial myth, kind of. It's how they perceive
something. Well, it could be associated with socioeconomic status too. I mean, that could be. You know,
yeah.
Particularly
mm-hmm.
if you look generationally, if their mother's generation were even less likely to work than they were, and you're
right.
more likely to be working if you're experiencing it, if it's not by choice.
Right. There could have been economic
yeah.
need that pushed, that had the moms working then. There could have been lack of fewer supports, right? We didn't even have the, FMLA in place, so it's like, fewer supports for doing that maybe, and it must be the moms telling them about it, or they're remembering, early child care, but no, it's not their own memories, right? So we know for that.
To see with other siblings could be.
Yeah,
things.
I know several women whose mothers worked who chose not to work because their mothers worked, and that the mothers were surgeons, so it
wow.
wasn't, not all mothers mm-hmm. were surgeons, but surgeons, attorneys, one was
yeah.
a state judge. And
mm-hmm.
So it's actually, I've worried a lot about that. But it wasn't because they were forced to go do a pink collar job.
Right. It's interesting, in my own family, my grandma worked as a social worker in New York City. My mom was not employed, and then I've been a professor, so I've been employed. So I have that generational shift in my personal history. I'm the mother of two boys, so I won't get to see it what happens in terms of a girl for the future. But it's disturbing. I think it speaks to the fact that it's still there's not enough support, right, for women working, and that that they even the surgeons maybe wasn't equal pay for at those levels, or other issues. I remember seeing a Frontline documentary that was made a number of years ago called Hillary's Class, and it was before nodding heads, and in there was a woman who had been it was about the women who graduated Wellesley in Hillary Clinton's class, and they were the
1969.
Yeah, and they were the first generation to really break the glass ceiling. But there were some daughters of those women who didn't want to be employed, in a reaction to the employed moms. And I think that was my first exposure to that kind of pushback. And it's just been interesting to see. There was the zeitgeist, I guess, shifts. With time, what you just talked about with the marriage, is
fascinating.
So that's going back a few decades.
And just really fascinating, and the amount of belief that their future will be contingent upon their choice around marriage, and the enormity of how powerfully they view that. Which I, without any particular data, think it's kind of like they want to find a spouse who will support them running for office. But I really think it's a little bit like asking someone if I were going to say to someone like, Carrie, would you like to go hiking with me 3 years from next Wednesday? or in this case, it might be 15 years from
mm-hmm.
next Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be very hard
yeah.
for even a,
Right.
That's a heck of a...
I don't know if they're so nuts having that concern. I mean, I'm not sure.
I don't
know. I just want this to put out there. Let's just leave it out there. I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure. I think they can have that. I mean, I think it'd be worth. I wish we had more space. We're going back to. I wish we had more space for conversation about.
I mean, what I want.
So
to
I think
yeah.
there's an idea that kind of grow in your head beyond
yeah.
proportions of what's realistic. But
I want them to count on themselves.
Yeah, well,
my view is you cannot build your entire architecture of your vision for what your life will be that is contingent upon permission, desire, support, but to think much more realistically of what supports would I need,
mm-hmm.
where are the multitude of places I could get it,
mm-hmm.
how do I build it, what
right.
are the strategies in my toolkit,
right.
and how do I make sure my self-esteem is such that I'm okay with what different people in my life can and can't bring.
Mm-hmm.
But to put it in the Disney myth,
yeah,
with
a 50% and with a 50% divorce rate, it's also not too realistic to be.
Yeah, can I actually?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Pick up on
yeah.
this in a more just twisting and then more academic. I do think it would be interesting to look at among your aspirations and to see if there's a way of asking some questions that do look at the function of college for marriage market. So there is. I mean, I think
mm-hmm.
that's a valid. There's
mm-hmm.
some interesting studies. Nan Cohane did an interesting study on, was it 20 or 25 years of women in Princeton
mm-hmm.
or something like that, and
mm-hmm.
and there are some issues at Princeton and Harvard and some of these other elite places where the women and the men, they come in mm-hmm. with comparable leadership positions, but then they get into more traditional, there's a traditional, more traditional gender bifurcation mm-hmm. with the men in the more predominant leadership roles on campus
right.
than the women. And the Ivies and some of these elites, and one interpretation of that is marriage market. It's like marriage market concerns that might be evoking fulfillment of, you know, normative kind of gender expectations. It might be interesting to try to get at that, the salience of some of those, you know, do you know how plausible is it that you would meet your mm-hmm. future partner on campus or something like that? You know, questions mm-hmm. that might.
I think having the dialogue, having the workshops where these, you know, having the conversations where these kinds of things can really come out in the open would be really useful to have, and to see whether that, you know, if they're opting out of those kinds of positions, you know, like leadership positions on campus. I mean, I guess, yeah.
But I'm thinking your survey, whether or not you've got.
I have demographic. I don't have their.
But you've got, like, whether they expect, whether they've got, like, intrinsic rewards
yes.
from career or
right.
something like that.
Right. I also have, yes, and I also have data on whether they want power, prestige, how important power, income, and prestige is to them
yeah.
in their jobs. And that would be interesting to look at. Yeah.
I'm curious if, as a follow-up to this mm-hmm. Study, if there is any plan on your campus to disseminate this information broadly. And if, you know, it sounds like this information all women are empowered to know that they can be mothers and not have this.
Right.
You know,
well, thank you for asking. I thought I have to put my my feet where my mouth is. And as equity advisor, I do get to do workshops. And these workshops can be for students, you know, as well as faculty. Most of my emphasis has been on faculty. But I was thinking I'm going to do something. I'm going to do some kind of workshops to get this out there. I'm going to meet with the college counselors and see if we can. They have all kinds of workshops that they run anyway. And see if we can make this a curriculum. And not just, you know, not just my study, but be broader than that. And I think I'm looking forward to doing that. I think, I think that's okay. Thank you.
Question. Thank you for answering that. As a follow-up question, I'm also interested to know if you find that there may be any sort of legislative follow-up. You mentioned briefly some of the concerns around child care and
mm-hmm.
more subsidized care. And it seems like this may be another angle or perspective to give to legislators around how they can boost revenue for child care and a reason to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good idea, and I think we as researchers have to do more to make sure our work gets to the people who could, you know, could and should see it. Yeah, thank you.
We have time for one more question.
I was just wondering if it would be interesting to get the names. You said here if you were employed full time, and in your research, have you found much to do with people's perceptions of their own capacity to do it all versus their perceptions of generally.
That's a really interesting idea. I have done other work where I've looked at social comparisons. I've done some work like with the division of labor and looked at when men and women are happy, satisfied with the division of labor. If women compare themselves to to other women in terms of what they're doing, and men compare themselves to like a generalized other. Anyway, I'm kind of getting off tangent, but I've taken that notion of comparing yourself to your notion of what other, where you are placed to other people. And some of that could be personality, you know, so I think having a personality measure in there would be helpful. Self-esteem measure, yes. And having some of those kinds of, those, because people do, the research tends to show that having multiple roles is good, that it's energizing, that it's not a fixed sum, it's not a fixed pie. So research-wise would suggest that, you know, it's you know, things going well in one role can offset things not going well in another role. But whether an individual feels like she or he can do it all, probably, you know, is also the resources that they have, you know, where they've come from, what they're bringing to the table, too, could make a difference. I do have a last slide to thank you all for being here, my co-authors, Rachel Lucas-Thompson, Joanne Prowse, and my team of UCI graduate students who were involved in sending this survey.
Thank you very much. so I hope you'll have you all back next week. We've got about Alberto Alicina, who's the Nathaniel Robes Professor of Political Economy here at Harvard. He's going to talk about women in the plow, the historical origins of gender norms.